Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, January 7th. I'm Ray Graff. Our guest today is at the forefront of scientific research on UFOs. They call them UAP these days. Dr. Kevin Knuth is a professor of physics at the University at Albany. He is a former NASA research scientist who has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications and has been invited to speak in 18 countries. He can be seen on Netflix, in various documentaries, on National Geographic's UFOs Investigating the Unknown. We'll talk to Kevin Knuth today. Take your calls this hour, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. UFOs, Professor Kevin Knuth, and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. Kevin Knuth. Kevin is a professor of physics at UAlbany and the editor-in-chief of the journal Entropy. He's a former NASA research scientist, having worked at Ames Research Center in the Intelligence Systems Division, designing artificial intelligence algorithms for astrophysical data analysis. His current research interests include the foundations of physics, quantum information, autonomous robotics, the search for and characterization of extrasolar planets, and unidentified aerial phenomena. Dr. Knuth has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications and has been invited to give over 100 presentations in 18 countries. He is a great guest on this program. We'll talk about the cutting edge of UAP research today. You want to call in? Feel free. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And we have a couple of those already, but feel free to call. 800-348-2551. Dr. Kevin Knuth, welcome back. Happy New Year. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for having me.
Big news in November. This is, I think it was in the TU, but it was also from the UAlbany publicity department. University at Albany receives major gift to advance scientific research on unidentified aerial phenomena. Big deal.
It's a huge deal. We were so excited to get that. A local business owner, Tony Gorman, generously donated to the University at Albany to support our UAP work, which is really fantastic.
Why? I mean, he's a layman. I'm a layman, too. I've been interested in this stuff 50 years. But what drove him to this?
Yeah, well, he had said that he's always been interested in the topic, and he saw me and professors Matthew Shadagas and Cecilia Levy, we were on a local news station. It was just the local nightly news. They came and did a piece on our work, and he happened to see that and then decided, oh, I would like to donate and support this. I want to learn more. So first he came to visit the lab, and we showed him around the lab and told him what we were doing and discussed that with him, and then he wanted to donate, which was fantastic.
Well, I mean, you and Matthew, and I have not met Cecilia yet, but you do great work, and it's well known across the country and across really the world in UAP research. You brought in another heavyweight, Dr. Eric Davis, to work with you on this. What do you hope to learn? You got some money. UAlbany, I presume, is happy about this.
Oh, very happy, yeah. it's great.
What are physics and learn?
Well, we want to get to the bottom of this. This is an enduring mystery. It's been, certainly UFOs have been in the American consciousness for the last 80 years.
And data and physical analysis. Current research is current research and
made minimal attempts to study them, you know, minimally funded, very poorly funded and poorly performed attempts to study these seriously. They clearly have been collecting data on them when they can get it. And are keeping some of that information quiet.
Well, how are you going? First of all, what data do you hope to collect and how will you collect it? Assuming the government has more resources at its fingertips than you do. You have a fair amount now. You've received a generous gift. You have a prestigious university backing you on this. But how are you going to get that data, and what specifically are you looking for?
Yeah, we want to get hard scientific data on the objects themselves. We're going to start simple We don't even have a taxonomy of what these things are yet. So we don't, there are different types of objects that people call UFOs or UAPs. Some of them are clearly metallic, metallic disks or black triangles. There are the plasmoid orbs. They're just orbs of plasma. And it's not clear what any of these things are. They probably all aren't. Nobody's saying that they're all alien spaceships.
That's a key to this, right?
Yeah, it's an important key, yeah. We don't know what any of these things are, and they could all be very different from each other and have different sources, and that's what we want to get to the bottom of. So we have identified some locations nearby. The Pine Bush in the Hudson Valley was had a UFO flap in the 1990s. And
yep.
So, and there still are many UFOs seen in the Pine Bush, New York area. So we have a site actually in Connecticut where we have access to a reservoir there. There's a reservoir where actually a police officer, 2 years ago in November, had seen this large orb hovering over the road. This thing was about the size of a Mini Cooper, and he shined the police light on it, and the thing shot across the lake or shot across the reservoir to the other side. And he got some videos of it when it was on the other side, which is interesting.
And the videos are great. And they were on, I believe, News Nation first. And
they
I think a couple years ago I sent you the link. And you know, what can you – you can learn stuff by looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
But what scientific data can you gather from something like that?
Right. So we want to get multiple images from different locations so we can perform triangulation, so we can measure sizes of objects. You can't get the size of something or the speed of something from just a photograph. Everything's angular, right? So you need an actual something that gives you a distance scale. So we need to take multiple photographs from or multiple videos from multiple directions. That'll give us speeds and accelerations, which will help us characterize what these objects can do. And monitoring them over time, you can determine whether they behave intelligently. If you try to interact with them, you shine a light on them and you see what happens. That's one thing we can do. We want to use spectrometers to gather what are called spectra. So we can look at it's basically what a prism does is it breaks the white light up into a rainbow. But we can do this more precisely for infrared light, ultraviolet light, and the visible light. And from that detailed spectra, you can tell how the light is being made. Is it being made by a plasma, by a real plasma, where you have got electrons being ripped off the gas? And is that gas nitrogen and oxygen? You can determine that, or is it something else?
Now, I think that those methods, specifically this light spectral analysis, I think Ruppelt was doing that in the 50s for a time. I think this goes way back.
Yeah, people have tried this. And in fact, in 1952, in Los Alamos, while they were working on the hydrogen bomb, they were having problems with what they called green fireballs. These green fireballs would show up usually during missile tests at White Sands Missile Base. And they actually put Dr. Lincoln LaPasse on the project. He studied meteorites. That's what he did. And he was an expert at tracking meteorites. He could, from witness observations, actually track the trajectory of a meteorite and find the object. That's what he was good at, and that's what they wanted him to do. And so they had tried to study these things, tried to track them, never found an object. And in fact, some of these green fireballs were observed going up rather than down.
Yeah.
So these clearly aren't meteorites. And he quickly determined they weren't meteorites. They had gotten some spectral information from them, and they're the wrong color green. They were not the right. They didn't have the right spectral footprints. Right.
So when you say the right color, some meteors can be green.
Some meteors are green. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said this was the wrong frequencies of green. Yeah. It was and so they actually had meeting. Most scientists don't know this. Many of the scientists at Los Alamos working on the Manhattan Project had seen these things. I mean, these things were relatively common. And the first general explanations, they're just meteorites, right? Which is why they brought in a meteorite expert. The problem is that meteorites don't happen for a year. We see meteorites, you know, like when the Taurids show up or the Geminids, they show up. That's because you have got a cloud of broken up cometary material in orbit around the sun, and, and the Earth passes through it during its orbit. That's when we see meteorites. It only happens for a couple of days for a group of meteorites. But this had been going on for months in New Mexico. And meteorites are global. They're not located to a particular county in New Mexico.
Right.
And so it was clear that something odd was going on. In fact, Edward Teller, who designed the first hydrogen bomb, his take on this was that, and I believe he even saw them, his take on it, because they weren't making any sound, there was no sonic boom associated with them, he figured that they were some kind of electromagnetic phenomena that we didn't understand. And that could still be the case.
Could still be the case. We know from reports over the last 30 years that, and you've studied this, you've done some, you have more papers coming, but the possible connection between nuclear tests and nuclear technology and nuclear plants and everything else and the so-called interest of the so-called UFOs. There seems to be a correlation, right?
There is a huge correlation, yeah.
So what inference do you make? You're a scientist. I can say anything I want. I mean, the moon could be made of green cheese. You're a scientist. What inference can you make responsibly about that?
From the data that's been gathered so far, there was a study done by the Society of the Scientific Coalition of UAP Studies, SCU. They did a study of sightings near nuclear sites as compared to nearby military bases and nearby population center cities. And they were able to show that the sightings near nuclear sites were statistically significantly higher than even the military bases or the population centers where you have more observers.
I know this goes back to the days before, well, just about the time we broke the sound barrier for the first time.
It goes back to certainly the times when we started building nuclear sites.
Yeah, and so the 40s.
Yeah, the 40s. And one of the things that they found that was really interesting is the sightings of UFOs at these sites started when we started constructing the sites before there was radioactive material there, which is really odd. It all points to, so what I can say scientifically as a scientist from this data alone, it points to intelligent surveillance, very intelligent surveillance.
Let's take a quick break. Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest. Dr. Knuth is part of the team that is studying in a scientific way UAPs at UAlbany. We'll talk more about the research and take your calls, 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Kevin Knuth joins us from UAlbany today, and they just got an endowment gift from an Albany area businessman to support cutting edge science on UAP or UFO, whatever you want to say. You know, one of the things you're going to collect, I understand from looking at this press release, is radar data. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that always struck me about if it is, I don't think it's one phenomenon, to be honest with you. I think it's a whole bunch of things over the last several years that sort of get
I would agree, yeah. There's multiple phenomena at play here.
But the ability to go stealth, the ability to go invisible, the ability to be seen. I'm just finishing an old book from the 70s, Utah UFO Display by Dr. Frank Salisbury. And one of the points he makes is it would seem they want to be seen. Mm-hmm. It's not a scientific question. But
they're not trying to hide. That's
do
for
you
sure.
agree? But I mean, they can be seen if they want to be seen, if they are a thing.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things. So if you go along with the hypothesis that these are craft of some kind, which in some cases really appears to be the case, the next question is why do they have lights on them?
They want to be seen.
They want to be seen. They don't have any problems with being seen. So that's a really interesting situation.
Or their misidentifications.
Yeah,
is
that's
this
possible
whole,
too.
Is it all a house of cards constructed in sort of a societal way, a cultural way, making something that isn't there there, in your opinion?
I think what's difficult about this is you have people are witnessing multiple phenomena or multiple things.
Right.
I don't want to use the word phenomena here because some of these things are identifiable.
Yeah.
Many of these things are airplanes. Many of these things are helicopters. In fact, during the drone flap last November through February or so, mainly in New Jersey, but it was actually happening all over the planet, which was interesting. I had people sending me photographs of lights in the sky, and my brother Joshua lives in Wisconsin. he's excellent at identifying aircraft. He knows every kind of aircraft like off the top of his head. So he's a great resource for me. So I'll send him this. I sent him this picture of this, you know, this pattern of lights that somebody had seen hovering over their house, and I sent it to him, and I was like, "What is this? What do you think this is? Is this a helicopter or an airplane?" And within like 15 minutes, he messages me back. He goes, "Oh, it's a Leonid or Leo. I don't even know. I don't remember off the type." He knew what kind of helicopter it was, and then he was sending me photographs showing me the light patterns. And yeah, he was right. I mean, they matched perfectly.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Susan in Greenfield writes, "What's the most exciting trend you've been working on recently around the detection or observation at the level of your work?"
Well, what we've been doing right now is basically getting ready to go observing at the sites we've picked out so far, nearby sites that we have a high probability of seeing something.
I want to go, man.
Sure, you can come.
Yeah.
you need eyes on the sky, right? So, so we have a site in Connecticut that we plan to go to. And in fact, we were there last May, Professor Matthew Shadagas was observing for 5 nights. I was only able to observe for 1 night because we were working to publish our New Science of UAP paper.
Yeah.
And he observed for 5 nights. And in fact, he calls me up one night so excited. He said, "Oh my God, I just saw this giant ball of plasma." And he's begging forgiveness in the text message. He goes, "Kevin, I'm so sorry. You're going to be upset with me. I didn't collect all the data I could have." And I said, "Why?" And so I'm on the phone with him. "Why? What happened?" He goes, "Well, there's this giant ball of plasma." And he goes, "I had to see it through a telescope." So he said, instead of getting measurements from some of our other equipment, he decided to try to focus the telescope on this thing. And he looked at it through a telescope and he said it was a giant ball of plasma. It was amazing. But he felt bad that he had worked to do this. And I said, "Dude, don't feel bad. You needed to see, you're a scientist, you needed to see it through a telescope." And people claim all the time, "Why don't astronomers see these things through telescopes?" Well, one did.
Right.
I mean, now we did.
Yeah.
And you saw it and you know it wasn't an airplane. You know it was a ball of plasma of some kind.
Well, yeah. He obviously needs more help. I mean...
Yeah, we do, definitely.
All right, I'm up for the next one. So, you know, back in the, I don't know when it was, late 80s, there was this very celebrated case of Mr. Ed Walters, okay? And he was in Florida, and he took these so-called amazing Polaroids, which may or may not have been real. To me, they sort of didn't pass the sniff test just from looking at them, right, but I'm not an expert.
I've seen many like that. It's hard.
Bruce McAbee stood for them for a while. I don't know if he eventually disavowed them. But they gave Ed, at one point, these were ongoing sightings, and they gave him a stereo camera. How far, you had mentioned taking stereo photographs or photographs from different spots so you can triangulate.
Right.
How close can the cameras be together?
Yeah, that puts a limit on the distance that you can measure, right?
Yeah.
And so eventually there's a distance for which it isn't going to make much difference for either of the two cameras.
Right.
So if you're looking at something a mile away, you're going to want these things hundreds of feet apart.
Right.
And so probably a stereo camera isn't going to do it for you unless the thing's hovering right in front of you.
Okay. Number here is 800-348-2551. Some callers on the line, but let's grab another couple of emails. Here's another one. Says, "Have you seen any other zones or effect areas like those on Catalina Island where you were or in Connecticut?"
Yeah, there are other places, and they are not easily accessible to us. You know, it takes money to travel, and we would have to ship equipment, and all. So that takes more money than we have. You know, we have a generous donation to get started with, but,
right?
But we don't have enough to mobilize to some of these other sites. So one of the other sites is in northeastern Puerto Rico, where the Aguadilla case happened. That was where a Homeland Security camera had captured a football-sized shaped object, probably about 5 feet across, flying across the airfield in Aguadilla, Puerto Rico.
No chance that was a bird. I've seen that video.
No, because it flies out over the ocean and it goes underwater.
Yeah.
It goes underwater without creating waves. So it hits the water at about 100 miles an hour. No waves. You can actually track it underwater and coming out. It only slowed down to about 85 miles an hour underwater.
Yeah.
And then at some points actually sped up. So you were actually able to track it underwater. So it's these things are very odd.
You have an interesting job. Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. Before we get to the phones, and we'll do it in just 1 second, you know, you've looked at some of these Navy videos that have been out there. And as I understand some of the science you're doing, you're trying to, A, track the acceleration of these things, and also gauge the power necessary to make these accelerations from zero to I don't know what speed they went. It seems like we're at the cusp of being beyond physics.
Yeah, that's the power. So that's one. I've given a talk on that at our university just in November, talking about the power necessary to make some of these maneuvers. And it is crazy. I mean, you're talking terawatts of power, gigawatts, you know, hundreds of gigawatts up to like a terawatt of power. That's it's much, much more than the, what is it? I think 11 gigawatts, something like that, is the, on that order is the, basically nuclear power plants are on the order of a gigawatt.
Interesting.
Of power,
right? Yeah. Okay.
Hundreds of megawatts to gigawatts of power. So this is, so in the Nimitz case, the power required to make the maneuvers it made, the difficulties we had to know the power, you have to estimate the mass of the object. And we lowballed it as much as we could. The Tic Tacs in the Nimitz case in 2004 were about the same size as an F-18. So your first guess, well, let's just use the mass of an F-18. But we tried to lowball it. We took 1/10 of that mass.
Right.
And then you calculate the amount of power, and it's 1,000 gigawatts, 1,100 gigawatts. So that's 1.1 terawatts of power to make the maneuver, which is more than the entire nuclear power output of the United States.
So
in
then,
this one little craft the size of an
F-18,
which then is amazing.
Somebody might say, well, then, and this is a terrible argument to make, and mm-hmm. this has been made against UFOs forever. It can't be, therefore it isn't. But this would suggest that this just can't be. It can't. Nothing could to generate that power.
It suggests we've got something wrong.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, what's wrong? Were the observations wrong? Or our understanding of what you can engineer wrong, or is our understanding of physics wrong? And you have to worry about all these possibilities if you want to get at the truth. So
you have to take little small bites, don't you?
Yeah. That's why we're trying to collect our own data. Let's get little small bites. Let's figure out what kinds of objects are out there. What are the ones that are going to be that we can easily classify as natural, or what are the prosaic phenomena that are easily identifiable? Which ones don't we know about yet that are clearly natural objects that we could then study? Or what are the ones that appear to be craft that appear to be made by non-humans, and there are some of those too. That's interesting.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest today, and we'll go to the phones just now. You know, anybody who listens to this show knows the esteem that I hold scientists. To me, to be at this level and to have that curiosity and then to act upon it is something really admirable. Do you ever get to that stage where you say, I'm never going to figure this out. Forget it.
Yeah.
I'll teach my classes.
I worry about that all the time, especially when, you know, some of these people have been studying UFOs for 60 years.
Yeah.
You know, like Richard Hoffman, who helped found SCU, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. He's been studying this since 1965. That's the year I was born.
Yeah.
You know, and as these people are getting up in years, some of them are thinking, well,
Did I waste all that?
I might die and never figure any of this out. And that's really true. I mean, you have people who have already passed, like Stanton Friedman and Bruce Maccabee, who studied this for a long time. And no, they didn't. What did they figure out? They figured out it might be alien as far as they got.
All right, well,
and I would like to get further, but is there a lot of hope for that? I don't know.
I don't know, man.
It's a hard problem, actually.
I'm on your side. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. We go to Hobart, New York. Jeffrey, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I had an experience with a friend of mine one time. We were camping on the King's Range in California. It's the mountain meets the ocean. And we were camping out, and we're watching satellites. We're like, oh, there's a satellite. So the satellite's, you know, slowly going across the sky. And then all of a sudden, a light comes up behind it and follows it. And then all of a sudden, zips off at like a 45-degree angle, like really fast. And we're like, did you see that? And it's like, I know that satellite's going very fast, but that light that just followed it and zipped off is going way faster. Any comments on that craziness?
Yeah, well, first, it's not craziness. It's an interesting sighting, and this happens to a lot of people. It's not rare. It's difficult to know how fast that second object was going compared to the satellite, because you don't know how far away either the satellite or that object was. That's one reason I mentioned that we're trying to do triangulation, is because then you need to get some distance scale to be able to get a speed.
We're like, holy crap, that satellite's got to be moving pretty fast. But whatever followed it and zipped away was going a lot faster.
Yeah, so the space station in orbit is going about 17,000 miles an hour. So it's
holy crap.
So that's really fast, yeah. And the UAPs that we have radar data on, there are multiple cases where they've been tracked at 40,000 miles an hour. So you're right. It's twice as fast as some of these satellites. Yeah.
All right, Jeffrey, I'm going to let you go here, but quick comment. Go ahead.
Thank you. What we saw was going way faster than satellite.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Jeffrey.
Thanks a lot. You know, the thing is, Jeffrey, I have no reason to believe he's lying.
No.
And I have every reason to believe he saw something he didn't.
This happens all the time.
How can you? It's one data point. How do you get anything out of it? Again, we are now getting into the point of almost folklore. There are so many stories, and you and I were talking about this before the show, where people, you know, Hopkinsville, 1955, where these people had little elf-like creatures, and they shot at them with guns, and they pestered them all night.
They shot up their roof in their house, the inside of their house, shooting at these things.
Right.
They were raiding their house. That's a strange story. Yeah.
But, I mean, this is what I talked about, this huge sort of umbrella where it's all this paranormal sort of
weirdness.
Yeah.
So much weirdness.
How do you get any science out of it?
Well, that's really hard. I don't think that it's wise to just totally discount and ignore the anecdotes, because, you know, it's anecdotal data. You can't do much with it scientifically, but you can still learn from what people tell you.
Yeah.
You don't have to believe it all 100%. I kind of try to hold it all in my mind and, all right, well, that's an interesting story. That's an interesting story. And look for commonalities. Is there some commonality that sticks out at you? And that's what you can maybe learn from that.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest today. Dr. Knuth is a UAlbany physics professor, and he's leading a group that is very much doing scientific research on UAPs, and I find it really fascinating. Let's go to Kingston. Howard, you're on. Howard, go ahead.
Hey, guys. How is it going?
Good.
Good. Thank you, Howard.
Hey, I got two things. First off, is a real quick thing, is I used to live out in New Mexico by the Sandias, and saw some crazy lights out there. But the question I have for you guys is that you were mentioning that these things can go stealth, right? And that they have, like, they have the ability to be seen. And they, obviously, I would assume that they have the ability to assume that they're being watched, right? Why? The question is, if they know that they're being watched, why haven't they made contact, would you say?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. But
yeah, that's a tough one. Knowing whoever So in some cases, these things appear to be highly advanced craft. And to understand the thinking of whoever made this craft, I think, is beyond us at
it's
this
pointless,
point.
It's pointless, really, isn't it?
It's just speculation, so it's hard to know.
Yeah, Howard, you know, I think we all get in this trap. You say, well, why hasn't it landed on the White House lawn? But, I mean, would a cat
think... We're the red-headed stepchild.
Right. Would a cat think that way about what would humans do? I think that there are some... If there is an intelligence behind this, it's sort of pointless for us to try to figure out what they're thinking. It's much better to do what Dr. Knuth is doing and trying to get some data that is usable and maybe will further the scientific look at this stuff.
Yeah, there's a group at SCU right now that's doing a study trying to get a handle of their intentions in these cases. And it's an interesting study, and they've... one thing that they found interesting that they've, this is not published yet, but one thing interesting that they had found was that in the early 1940s, most sightings happened during the daytime. And they didn't seem to be frightened off by observers, you know, when people show up and are watching them. And it wasn't until around the 1950s that they shifted to almost 100% nighttime operations, it seems.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's
none of it does, though.
It's very strange. And then the sightings around public sightings around cities didn't really pick up until the 1970s.
Really?
Yeah, so there's some interesting correlations there. It'll be interesting to see what they pull out of those data sets.
You know, Dr. Kevin Knuth is on our show maybe twice a year, and every time I'm left shaking my head saying, wow, there's a lot of stuff out there that I just don't know about and probably never will. Let's get back to a little break here, and then we'll be back to your calls, 800-348-2551. John Harrington there, Steely Dan guitarist deluxe from one of his solo records. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Kevin Knuth is here. It's UAP and scientific research of same. What's next for you guys in your crew at UAlbany?
We're going to go out and start collecting data when it gets warm.
Yep.
Right now, my colleague Matthew Shadagas is traveling. He's been doing a lot of materials analysis of potential crash debris. People have been sending him debris from purported crashes, and he's been working to measure isotopes. He has a new method to called neutron activation, which he's developed to measure isotopes non-destructively.
Anything you can say about any findings?
Better for him
okay,
to say
fair
it.
Enough. Well, you gotta get him in here then.
Yeah, I'll get him in there.
All right, Glenn writes in, Are you familiar with Salvatore Cesar Paez and his U.S. Navy patents?
Yes, I am. Yep.
So what's your take?
It's tough.
Tell us about what they are first.
Yeah, so these are various patents that that Paez had put in through the U.S. Navy, and they're patents related to warp drive type problems, trying to create warp drive. You know, gravitational.
This is 20 years ago, or I remember this a little bit.
I don't
bit.
Think it's that long ago. I think it's closer to 10 years, but okay. I'm not. Well, maybe 20 years. Okay. As I get older, time becomes harder to estimate. But yeah, so it could be up to 20 years ago. You know, I've looked at the patents, and in fact, some of my other colleagues at UAlbany who are theoretical physicists had looked at them as well. I had, you know, had sent them to them to look at, and they were too vague to be able to really pinpoint whether they're doing anything interesting or useful.
I mean,
and so it's a tough one, and this happens with patents sometimes. They can be too, you know, people can patent things just to kind of plant a flag, right?
Right.
Without actually solving the problem, and that appeared to be more like the case.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I have no idea how the government works with scientific secrets and things that might have future use. If it was something that the government was hip to, would that have not disappeared? Would it appear in the patents?
Well, it's not clear, right? I mean, it's not clear what they do, because sometimes they hide things in plain sight, right? and sometimes they don't. So it's hard to know. In this case, with the patents, they seem to be very vague on several points.
Okay. All right.
And
Glenn,
so I suspect that they were planting a flag and there were some aspects of the, you know, if it's a real patent and actually works,
you mean,
then maybe they were trying to keep some parts secret still.
Could the whole thing be disinformation?
It's tough. It's so hard to know.
All right. This further from Glenn, can you talk about transmedium phenomena and whether it simply refers to underwater, to atmosphere, to space, or is there an interdimensional aspect being explored?
Oh, that's a good question. Transmedium usually refers to atmosphere to water, water to atmosphere, and then also includes space. And I've done a lot of inquiring about whether, to what degree UAP have been observed going into land as well, right? Can they go into mountain? I mean, there have been some sightings of going into mountains.
Skinwalker Ranch, for one. Yeah.
So I've inquired about that, because if you actually have these things actually traveling through solids, that's also interesting. So the interdimensional part is very difficult. And in fact, Matthew Shadagas and I are writing a paper right now on that problem, because we don't have any evidence in physics for any more than three spatial dimensions.
You can't really test it, can you? I mean, string theory, what can you do with something like
string theory? Well, yeah, and in those cases, those aren't dimensions you can be in. They're what are called curled-up dimensions. They're microscopic, so it's a totally different thing. So macroscopic, big dimensions that you could hide in or live in, are we don't have any evidence for them. In fact, the theoretical evidence we have for space-time physics, and I have two papers on this myself, is that there are three spatial dimensions, and that's it.
So
it's tough.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest today. It's UAP Research, 800-348-2551. Let's go to Kingston. Ellington, you're on.
Oh, hey there, guys. You were speaking a bit about the debris and other, you know, I was wondering how you could study traces of these UFOs or UAPs, and if crop circles would count as one of those. Or I'm not sure if that's just a complete myth, but I was curious about the relation between crop circles and UFOs.
Well, thank you for your question. And that's an interesting question. It's not clear. At first, I thought you said it, whether that's a complete mess, but I think you said myth.
Myth, I think.
But I think it probably – all this is a complete mess in some sense. It's hard to parse through and sort through all of it. I recently published a paper on the new science of UAP studies, which we published that in a Progress in Aerospace Sciences. And it's a very long paper that basically goes through and summarizes the scientific work that's been done to study UAPs. And in researching that, I learned about the work from Dr. Phyllis Budinger. She's a chemist, and she has done a lot of work on studying dirt from landing sites. She has done a lot of work with that, and she's actually found interesting chemical traces like calcium oxalate and things like this that they have in common. And I think that's neglected. I mean, there have been very few chemists working in this field. And in fact, scientific skeptics will often say, why is there no physical evidence? Well, there's plenty of physical evidence. And I think that usually it isn't collected by the right people. It's not collected carefully enough. And then it's not studied by the right people, and I think that's a big problem.
Thanks
a very neglected part of the problem.
The crop circles thing, little inside baseball in the 80s, mid-80s, I was a member of MUFON, and every month they would send a journal out. Mm-hmm. And they started getting into, like, every month was crop circles. And it kind of drove me crazy, because it really is not – it's another thing.
It's another thing that it's not clear how it fits, yeah.
And there are hoaxes involved with that as well.
Right.
And so, you know, I've sort of made amends with them, but it's that was tough. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Let's go to RK in Cohoes. RK, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Doctor.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for calling.
Raymond, I think, not to say there's a simple explanation here, but the way I see this thing, the way I read into it, is that this is you're dealing with supernatural phenomenon. You're dealing with spiritual phenomena. You know, you're talking about entities, you know, going into mountains, transcending physical space and time, transcending and defying everything we know regarding not only the human physical world, but the universal physical world, and not only the laws of Earth, but the laws of the universe. Thereby, I can only deduce that we are dealing with that of the supernatural, hopefully. And from what I understand, you have instances where these things have disabled nuclear weapons. So hopefully these are, I will say, angelic.
They've also activated them, but that's a different story. I mean, over in Russia, they activated them.
Maybe of the demonic as well.
Interesting.
I know this isn't a religious program.
No, dude.
I just feel that. So I guess my question is to the doctor, has what I just said been considered in the scientific community?
I think that this is great.
This is an excellent question. Thank you for calling with it. This is actually the aspect that makes this whole topic hard to study, is because it's not clear what's going on in many of these cases. UFO sightings and encounters are very often related to other, what we would call, paranormal phenomena. And I mentioned in another podcast recently that sometimes people who encounter UFOs will find themselves sometime in the next week levitating. I mean, stuff like that happens, and it's how do you make any sense of this? So my to try to answer your question is that anything supernatural is also natural, and I consider that, as a scientist, that is worthy of study as well as anything else that we're used to. I think it's just natural stuff we haven't studied yet. And that's my take on the supernatural. So, heck, if they're spirits, fine. That's cool with me. I'm happy to study spirits if I can find a way to study them.
You know, I thought it was interesting. There's a movie, Age of Disclosure. I know you've seen it, and I've seen it, and a lot of people have seen it. It's a very popular documentary. I think it's on Amazon. Might be other places now. But some of the scientists, and they have some major league sort of government spook scientists as on their show. And some say, you know, we tried to get into some of the old research, and people at the Pentagon said, no, you're dealing with demons here. You're done. Don't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And so there is that thought in some parts of at least our government.
Yeah, it's not clear that's wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, that very well could be a possibility. We don't know yet.
All right, let's go.
But I want to figure it out, so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go to Douglas, Massachusetts. Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest. Douglas, go ahead.
I'm going to share a quick story with you. It was summertime, probably 5 years ago, in Wendell, Mass, on Bear Mountain. I heard a Chinook circling in the woods around my area. I'm in the woods. I ran out of the house, and I'm quite familiar with Chinooks because I'm ex-military. And I stood in my backyard and watched the woods light up with a Chinook. And in front of that Chinook and below it, right at treetop level, there was a green pulsating orb. And I'd say it was about the size of my F-250 pickup if you made a circle out of that. And it was below, and it moved really slow, went right over my property, and it was lit up by that Chinook by a light underneath it. I was stupefied. After it passed over my property, I ran in the house, went on social media, and I said, did anybody else just have a green orb with a Chinook above it, flying it, following it? And five people within 15 minutes, within about a 15-mile radius from my house, confirmed the exact same thing I saw. And my daughter confirmed it from her bedroom window also.
Wow, that's a great sighting. That's really interesting.
How long ago was this, Douglas?
I'd say this was probably 4, maybe 5 years ago. And once seeing that, I'm convinced what I experienced in that 3 minutes of observing this and being right under it, and I could feel the prop wash from the Chinook. This thing was right above tree level on my farm. And it blew my mind.
Wow!
Have you reported it to MUFON? They collect sightings reports.
I did not.
And it would be good if you could report it, and the other witnesses could report it too. That's one way that we can collect data to look for commonalities. Certainly.
Yeah.
And there's the Enigma app too.
That's true too.
The interesting thing was, three of the people that got back to me, I know these people. Because I know a lot of people in the area, and they said, Doug, I saw the exact same thing, and we have no idea. So
It happened.
One of my first sightings is I watched four F-16s look like they were dogfighting a sphere. I watched it through binoculars.
How long ago was that?
That was 1987.
Okay, so that was a while ago.
Quite a while ago.
Douglas, great call.
I didn't report mine either. I should admit that.
You know, I think that I've seen a few weird things myself, and there is a certain paralysis that takes over. You say, well, I should be taking notes, or I should.
Or something, yeah.
Yeah, and you just say, I got to look at this thing.
Yeah.
You know, here's what it is. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Now, what could we infer from Douglas's sighting? There's a Chinook helicopter and a green orb.
Somewhere there's records of what that Chinook helicopter was doing.
Right. So somebody knows
somebody
much
knows
more.
Somebody something. Yeah.
And the thing is, though, can you infer that this is just a government project? And the Chinook is escorting.
Well, you can't rule it out for that, but it may or may not be. It's tough.
Let's go to Ellen in Latham. You're on with Dr. Kevin Knuth. Go ahead.
Hi. Can we decipher the physics of the UAPs using the physics of the Earth?
So let's see. There's a difficult question for a few reasons. Let me just first explain that. So different UAPs appear to be different things. So there are going to be different physics and different phenomena involved. So the ones that I've been most interested in and looking at are the ones that appear to be highly advanced craft, where you've got speeds and accelerations that are just way off the charts of anything we're capable of. And in those cases, no, we can't explain the physics very well. It's hard to determine whether you're looking at something that is displaying advanced engineering, something that's very clever, because the whole point of, so engineering and science are two very different things. Science, you're trying to understand how the universe works, and engineering is you're trying to use how the universe works to try to get around problems and to bypass, you know, things. So very clever engineering often bypasses several physical problems that you might have. You know, how do you get a 747 off the ground? You know, anybody would have seen a 747, you know, 100 years ago, nobody would think that it could fly. But it's clever engineering that allows you to fly something like that. And I marvel at that every time I'm on a plane. So, you know, are we dealing with clever engineering here? Are we dealing with some physics we don't understand? We don't know the answer to that yet. I think we hold both hypotheses, keep them both on the table.
All right, Ellen, thanks for the call. This email,
thank you, Ellen.
Here's one, and we're about wrapped up here with Dr. Kevin Knuth, and I'll see you again in the summer. We'll do this all again, and maybe bring more of your team with you. This is from Vincent. How worried are those who are responsible for strategic defense when they can't determine what a reputable sighting is? If they can't determine that, it's a human adversary. Do they just dismiss it?
It is hard to know what's going on in the minds of the military at this point. When I first learned about UFO incursions at nuclear weapons sites, that was way back in when I was a graduate student, just starting at Montana State University in Bozeman, Montana. And they had had a cattle mutilation that night where two cows were killed with lots of UFO sightings. And so we graduate students were discussing this. And one of the professors came out and told us that that he knew people up at Malmstrom Air Force Base that were dealing with UFOs flying over nuclear weapons and shutting them down. And at the time, we thought, you know, we listened politely, and when he walked away, we all just laughed because our thinking was, if this was going on, the Air Force would be on red alert, right? Everybody would be on red alert,
yeah.
And that's clearly not going on. And later I learned one of the reasons I went to study UAP is when I learned that those incursions were real. I heard about them later. In 2015, I stumbled on Robert Hastings' press conference from 2010, where he had people like Robert Salas, who was at Malmstrom Air Force Base, the same Air Force Base. Turns out my wife's uncle was stationed at that Air Force Base. He knew all about the UFO incursions. So they know about these things. This is widely known to the people who are at these bases. But the U.S. government's not doing anything about it. So why? It's hard to figure out why.
We end with a question. You know what? Dr. Kevin Knuth, we're out of time, but I will see you this summer, and I'm in if you need any help in Connecticut or wherever else you're going.
Oh, sure. We'll let you know.
Count
that
me in,
great.
Brother. Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, providing more than 40 miles of trails for nature therapy and exploration beyond the shore of Lake George. HikeLakeGeorge.org. At Plaza Travel Center, presenting a small group trip from Albany to Patagonia and Argentina in October, escorted by Gene Gagnon. For trip details, gene@plazatravel.net. Thanks again to Dr. Kevin Knuth for being here today. Always a fascinating chat when he's here. Thank you for calling. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to our engineer, who might or might not be from Earth, Zach Malloy. Yeah, I don't know. Andrea Leong, Earthling, thank you very much for screening the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson. We'll see you too for that one.